This Week in Startups is brought to you by InBroker's Startup Insurance Program. Helps startups secure the most important types of insurance at a lower cost and with less hassle. Save up to 20% off of traditional insurance today at InBroker.com/twist. While you're there, get an extra 10% off using offer code TWIST. Miro helps take ideas from in your head to out there in the world with its ability to democratize collaboration and input. Sign up for free at Miro.com/startups. That's Miro.com/startups. And Crowdbotics. Great ideas can change the world. And Crowdbotics is the fastest way to turn those ideas into code. Get a free scoping session for your next big app idea at crowdbotics.com/twist.
All right, everybody. It's Friday. It's This Week in Startups, and Alex Wilhelm is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of TechCrunch Plus. Go sign up and subscribe for that. And Alex has been on the show dozens of times. And
yes, sir.
He knows tech. And you're like, a classic journalist. You don't get involved in too many... superfluous social, whatever, cultural issues. You like to talk about the business and the tech.
Yeah, to a degree. I think I'm recently castigated because I popped off a little bit during Silicon Valley Bank. And do you ever just hit the zeitgeist at the wrong time with the wrong people in the wrong way? Rhetorical for both of us, but like I got more flack in like 30 minutes about my SVB take than I had gotten in 2 years. And I was like, oh, this is why I mostly talk to my friends. Right.
Yeah. Right. No, it's what was your take on the SVB situation?
Okay. Don't, I paid penance for this. So don't shout at me, but I was like, don't bail out the rich before the FDIC announced that they were going to make the deposits. But what I didn't realize was how downstream the effects were going to go, et cetera, et cetera. So I learned. But people took it as like, oh, the media hates us. They're all communists. And I was like, I'm sorry. I apologize for my 7-word tweet.
Well, I mean, this was a subtle issue because I agree with the sentiment of don't bail out the rich, people who are placing bets. I don't feel like United Airlines management should get bailed out or I should get bailed out as a venture capitalist. I'm generally anti-bailout. But yeah, when you look past, and I didn't know the extent that Silicon Valley Bank was used by my kid's school. The public school in my district is a Silicon Valley Bank customer, and they were not going to be able to pay the teachers.
Right.
This was not, the name of the bank played big into this. And then the good news is, the management and the equity shareholders, not the good news, the fair news.
Yes.
The equitable news was that they did not get bailed out, and all we did was enforce FDIC. But I took the opposite side of it, which was like, holy cow, what I'm seeing from the inside as a venture capitalist now who does random acts of journalism as opposed to a journalist who covered venture capital.
Yeah.
I watched the bank run for Silicon Valley Bank occur in my feed, email, phone calls. And at the same time, people were moving it to Silicon Valley Bank to First Republic.
I was about to say,
The First Republic people were moving out of First Republic and putting it into Bank of America or JP Morgan. And I'm like, wait a second, bank runs can cause other bank runs. And then I was like, wait, I think there's a word for this.
I think there's a word for this. It might start with a C, O, contagion. Yeah.
Contagion. Yeah.
Well, okay, look, if we're going to bring up First Republic, before we get into this earnings stuff, did you see what happened to their stock today?
First Republic got demolished another 30% or something. I mean,
30 or 40, yeah. Yeah, okay, good. That was my question. Because my view is that this goose is cooked, but I wanted to make sure I wasn't being too pessimistic or negative.
You know, it's down 40%. It's got a market cap now of $685 million. 52-week high was 171, and it's trading at $3.67. So, like Silicon Valley Bank, an incredible brand with incredible people who work there.
Yeah.
And this like really custom banking where you can get somebody on the phone as opposed to cookie cutter banking at the big four or five, it really does serve a place in the world. And not just for rich people. This mom and pop stores, Main Street stores, they get to have a banker and they get to get a line of credit, all this stuff. So we got a serious problem. And I hope somebody buys this asset and maintains it. I mean, imagine if, I don't know, what's a big tech company that wants to be in banking? Oh, all of them.
Well, Apple. Yeah, I was about to say. Google Wallet, Apple Wallet.
Would be number one,
Microsoft, not so much, now that I think about it.
but Google for sure.
For sure. Yeah.
Amazon probably would take a swing. So if we're spitballing here, an Amazon First Republic takeover,
it would cost them what, like 12 minutes of revenue? Look, I mean, First Republic is now worth like two BuzzFeeds. That's bad. Your bank should never be worth a low multiple of BuzzFeed stock, right? Like,
I mean, it's been a while since you and I have caught up, but I mean, the BuzzFeed situation is bonkers. They were making $200 to $300 million a year, and I think their stock was trading at less than their revenue.
Oh yeah, their revenue multiple went below one, if I recall correctly. And I mean, by the way, did you know that Lyft's revenue multiple is also below one now?
I did not know that. I just saw that.
I think 0.9 last time I checked or something like that. I think Uber's 1.8. But like those businesses have also been repriced pretty extensively.
Yeah, it's if you refuse to show profits and in, you know, you just go for the growth number, which was rewarded in the ZIRP, in the zero interest rate market, it was rewarded. Oh, yeah. I can tell you, Dara's having a hell of a time turning around a battleship and saying, oh, we're supposed to go in the other direction. It's like, battleship, aircraft carriers do not turn, they're not like speedboats. It takes a little time to turn them around.
I'm just in awe that Uber isn't more profitable. And I know it's a complex business with a lot of tech that goes into it. There's insurance questions and markets and support, and there's lots of things. But like when I use Uber Eats, I am paying markup fees, delivery fee, and tipping. I am paying like 3x what the food costs. And you think it would just rain money down from the sky.
Right. Well, it turns out human beings in America doing service jobs went from a $7, $8 minimum wage to a to a $15 minimum wage in some cities. Yeah. And then in order to compete for them, you kind of got to hit $25 to $35. Or Americans are just not going to do those jobs. You close the borders. We have no immigration. Got 9 million job openings. So as weird as this whole economy is, but you know, the good news is, I think if you look at Facebook doing the layoffs, getting rid of management redundancies, there is a path to have your stock recover. And my understanding, is that Uber is taking all that very seriously. And I think you're going to see the free cash flow. I think they are reporting in the first week of May, like so that maybe next week.
That feels
week,
right.
Yeah. They're going to, I think they're going to surprise some people. People are, because what I always knew, having been an early investor, unless I don't have inside information now, was nobody would change their behavior, maybe like the bottom 1 or 2%, if you raise the price of a ride by a dollar.
Right.
And nobody changes their behavior. So I think now that they're, I don't want to say a monopoly, but a duopoly with DoorDash and a, you know, almost a monopoly with Lyft suffering, I think they're going to start printing money. I mean, that's my hope. I'm still a large shareholder. Talking my book.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, as someone who has depended on Uber and Lyft for, it's been so long now. I was in college when Uber rolled out in Chicago. And I actually got to go to their like Chicago launch party when they were just black cars. Like that's my history with the company. I have given them so much money over the years.
Yeah.
I would like them to persist because I still depend on them, you know? So I'm here for that.
Listen, we work with super early stage companies at my investment firm launch, you know, pre-series A, maybe you got a couple of $1,000 a month in revenue. You've raised a couple of $100,000, maybe $1 million, right? It's the early days, year one or two of a startup. And I'll be honest, a lot of times startups, they don't have their insurance. They haven't set that up yet. They haven't set up their accounting properly. They're getting things cleaned up. In fact, I was recently had a great startup, but they didn't have D&O insurance. That basically protects your directors and officers. That's the D, directors, people on the board. Officers, the people who work at the company, right? Directors and officers insurance is super important. So what do? We sent them right to InBroker. Our friends over at InBroker are a business insurance company that's built specifically for startups. You just fill out a simple application, right? And then startups get four quotes for four lines of coverage in 15 minutes. Four quotes, four lines of coverage, 15 minutes. Easy, breezy, lemon squeezy. That's right. They connect you with one of their expert brokers for unmatched service that goes beyond your policy. And listen, you might think, oh, it's too early to have insurance. It's not that expensive. It's not that complicated because InBroker makes it easy. So here's what I want you to do. Try InBroker today with the code TWIST and you'll get 10% off their startup package at InBroker.com/TWIST. That's InBroker.com/TWIST. We love InBroker. I use InBroker. They're an amazing team. They do a great job for startups. Whether you're in year one or year five, go use InBroker.com/TWIST.
On the cost front, though, that's going to kind of bring us into earnings, because I feel like everyone's trying to show off operating leverage these days, which is such a weird thing to discuss, because 2 years ago, you and I were talking about literally anything else.
Right. What are your new initiatives? Well, tell me about your self-driving unit. What about VTOLs? Right. What can you add to this party and this mix? And now it's like, what can we take away? How focused can we get? And, you know, people were hiring and buying office space 2 years ahead of plan. And that's what I think their best practice was. So if you're Facebook, Microsoft, Uber, whoever, Twitter, you're like, okay, what am I going to need? Imagine saying today, how many people and how much office space do I need in 2025? Let's buy it now. We'll just grow into it. It's hilarious.
I feel like you can't have more of a flip on that. I mean, when I was at Crunchbase, we were expanding and we were in like one floor of our building, then two floors of our building. And then it was like 2.5 floors of our building. And we were counting down until someone else left the other half of our floor so we could move. That company is now fully remote. And that office space is either empty or occupied, I think, by someone else.
It's pretty wild. I was in San Francisco on Monday. I had our accelerator come back in person for the first and the last weeks. It's a really great feeling. And then this Founder University program, which kind of comes before an accelerator, where we put $25,000 into companies that are just like haven't even incorporated yet. I had 100 of them, and I was at Fenwick's office for one and Wilson Sonsini's for the other. They're nice enough to host us and put out a nice spread. And walking between the two, Fidei to Embarcadero, I mean, Alex, compared to what we saw just 3 years ago, it was like being in a dystopian sci-fi film where you're like, oh, I am the last person. It was like a Twilight Zone episode. Like, remember the Twilight Zone? My favorite Twilight Zone episode is the one where Time, I think it's called, where the guy is in the library and he wants to read books. He's got really thick Coke bottle glasses. And he goes into a vault with like all the great old books. And then the vault closes and he gets locked in for 24 hours. And when he comes
out. This sounds great. Keep going.
This is amazing. I'm not going to tell you anything after this.
Okay.
Because that happens in the first 30 seconds. When he gets out of the locker, because it's a timed 24-hour locker, he has been reading books all night. His dream is to just not have to talk to people in the library, but just actually read the books. He comes out and the world's changed. I'll just leave it at that.
I can guess, but don't threaten me with a good time. Put me in a vault, 24 hours of just books. Dude, that sounds amazing.
That's what's just so great about this episode. I cannot wait to talk to you about this episode. And yeah, for folks asking about Uber May 2nd, but it's that office is not being counted in the 30% of offices in San Francisco that are vacant.
Yeah.
So now you sort of put in the shadow vacancies. It's probably 40. It might be 50%. I mean, I don't know how they ever recover.
A rebuttal to this, because I have a big soft spot in my heart for San Francisco. I lived there for 8-9 years.
Amazing city.
Amazing city. I'm a West Coast boy originally. This is in my DNA. And because both my sisters went to Stanford, I've been bopping around the Bay Area since I was like 8. And I just love it. People, I think, forget that SF is and always has been a boom town. And it will boom again, and then it will bust again. And we are currently in the trough of pain. And I fully respect that there's work to be done. Let's not get into politics on that. But like, I think SF will once again have its moment. It wasn't cool 10 years ago, or 15 now.
15,
And I'm sure in 10, it'll be cool again. So
I do think it's a boom bust cycle. I did see it. .com, Web 2, now. It does go through these things. It's not the first time that it got hollowed out. But, you know, it got built up too. And so it got built up and then hollowed out. And then the remote work thing combined with the safety issues, and again, not to get political, putting it all aside, you used to be able to sell somebody who was, you know, had a family who's a CFO, let's say. You want to be the CFO of Uber, Airbnb. Oh, you want to be the senior CTO. You got a family. Oh, great. Bring your family to San Francisco. Let me show you Dolores Park. Let me show you Pack Heights. Let me take you to Presidio. I mean, it's gorgeous. Let me take you to Tahoe. We'll go to wine country. Man, you could sell it.
Yeah.
And it's a hard sell now. And you had to sell it against, hey, it's expensive, but it's delightful. I mean, when San Francisco is on, it's on. It's just stunning and beautiful.
Yes.
To be able to go to Tahoe for the weekend and ski, or to go to Napa for the weekend and drink wine, and or to go south to Santa Cruz and surf. I mean, it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it heartbreaking. I'm really rooting for it to turn around.
Yeah.
BuzzFeed, 55 cents.
Yeah. What's the market cap?
I mean, I'm almost shocked to say it out loud. $76 million.
Oh, I'm so sorry. First Republic is 8x the BuzzFeed market cap. My mistake.
I mean, it literally reminds me of the dot-com era where cash on the books became greater than the valuation. So you could basically fire everybody, turn the website off, and make a profit. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Now, there are control issues, because my understanding is Jonah Peretti controls, I think, some amount of BuzzFeed. How is the news in the media business with the BuzzFeed news shutting down? Because that was a pretty elite group, was it not?
Super elite. In fact, I actually used to pay BuzzFeed News. They had some sort of like, give us $5 a month. You don't get anything for it, but you can give us money. And I always said, sure, I'll support the team. To me, it had already been sufficiently desiccated by layoffs and exits that when they finally stomped on the last bit of it, it wasn't the biggest shock. I think it was kind of sad to see the end of an era, because the hope was there's a company, it does all this silly stuff, it makes money, and you spend it on news. Huzzah, what a cool model. Isn't that great? And it turns out it wasn't. BuzzFeed, though, I don't have a lot of emotional connection to the non-news side of it, but I will say that it feels like a relic from a different era.
It does. It feels like Yahoo. Suddenly, it feels like not even Huffington Post or AOL or something. It's kind of
given that I currently work for some combination of the clips of AOL fused into Yahoo. I take that personally, but
well, I mean, the thing I will say, I'm friends with Jim Lanzone. It is incredible Yahoo's staying power. So Yahoo Finance, Yahoo Sports, like some of these services, and they actually redid Mail, are pretty fantastic. So I would actually take the Yahoo back, but I leave the AOL and the some of those other assets that just feel like they're just on cruise control, whatever.
So, well, we're on the podcast and we both have to behave. Tell me about Jim Lanzone, because I've slacked with him once. That's all I got.
Jim ran CNET, and he is a great steward of brands.
Mm.
And he can manage the two, when you run a publishing brand, a house of brands, if you will, like Condé Nast or like Yahoo Today with TechCrunch and other assets. I think they still own Engadget, my old brand.
Yeah.
You have to be able to balance what the advertising and corporate folks want to do to destroy brands and compromise them, and what the editorial group wants to do to make them excellent. And, there are some people who can take that tension, extracting value from a brand, making it hum, and then, not destroying it. And what happens to most people who are in those positions is they're just like shutting things down. They don't appreciate the fact that, the Engadget reader is different than the TechCrunch reader, is different than the Yahoo Tech reader, and the Yahoo, finance folks, even though finance overlaps with this, is a different audience. And the brands mean something to those audiences.
Yes.
He understands that the brands mean something to the audience, and it's okay if they overlap. What the overlap between Engadget and TechCrunch is always going to be 20%. And what somebody running the Huffington Post might do, some mid-level manager wonk might be like, oh, and they did this. They took Joystick, this incredible video game site that we had created, and they're like, we'll make it Huffington Post Gaming. And it'll just be HuffPost/gaming. And it's like, oh my God, that's death to the serious gamers who have been with this brand for two decades. And I think Jim Lanzone understands brands and how to be a good steward of brands for the people who love them and the advertisers who love them. But it's consolidation is how typical MBAs minds work. And they think efficiency and consolidation and who can we fire and what can we cut. And it would be like saying, you know what? You're directing this Marvel movie. You might as well throw Grogu in there, because he's popular, and you're like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, so,
Grogu, from Mandalorian. He'd be great. Why don't we make him one of the X-Men?
I knew that was a Star Wars reference. I wasn't sure what it was referring to.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to make Yoda part of the X-Men, and you're what?
Okay, but there's some great crossovers in comic book history, so
great. That's great for a one-off gimmick thing over the summer when we're kids. It's not good for the long-term, health of the brand, so you just got to be careful.
Yeah.
There is nothing like a good whiteboarding session. Don't I know it? Man, when you're there brainstorming ideas, collaborating, and you get those vibes that everybody's dialed in and you get your best ideas, you're putting your best foot forward. Well, it's hard to do, right? You got people spread all over the planet. We all work remote now. Well, Miro is a great tool for you to take your idea from inside your head and get it out there to the rest of the world. When you think Miro, I want you to think 0 to 1. Building a startup from scratch, it needs input from everybody. And Miro democratizes collaboration and input. So everybody gets a voice. It's much more than just a digital whiteboard. It's a visual collaboration tool that's asynchronous and powerful. Your team can collaborate on planning, researching, brainstorming, designing, all the feedback cycles you need to make your product and company a success. Miro equals 0 to 1, but faster. And here's the best part. Miro has a community of power users who are addicted to the product. And you know what they do? They make world-class templates all day long. Go to Miro.com/Miroverse. And one that founders might love is the Complete Naming Mega Workshop. So many startups, they have trouble picking a great name in the early days. This workshop is going to really help you and your team brainstorm a great name. That's iconic. Faster inputs equals faster outcomes, and velocity is how startup wins. You all know that. So go to sign up for Miro right now for free. Miro.com/startups, Miro.com/startups to sign up for free.
Earnings.
Great to catch up.
Yeah, I've missed you.
But let's talk earnings.
So we're going to start with Google. Okay. And I just want to say that Google Cloud, after many years of losing money, demonstrated operating profit in the last quarter. Ring the buzzer. Give them 10 points. That's fantastic. I'm sure that Ruth Porat, the CFO over there, has been looking through the numbers to make that all work out. I presume there was probably some trimming here and there. But what really took my mind here when I read this earnings report was that revenue was actually up just 3% year over year.
Yeah.
And that's a really small number, and it's very close to zero.
Which is stunning. If you think about this collection of stocks, could we really call them like high growth stocks anymore? You know, when you get to single digits, they're not high growth stocks. But what is great is that in an advertising recession down market, there's some profits, right? Because Facebook hit some down quarters, and Meta, Facebook, I'm going to still call it Facebook.
Same diff. Everyone knows what you mean.
Yeah. And so I do think the fact that they cut those 12,000 employees and they told everybody, hey, a little bit back to the office, a little more focus. It's not enough. They haven't gone full Zuckerberg, but Sundar doesn't have that ability because he's not the founder. And he's a consensus builder. And so I think the act of them getting their act together and cutting costs and getting earnings up, you know, a non-founder has a harder time with that because they just can't come in and say, here's what we're doing. They have to build consensus amongst leaders of groups. You saw Susan Wojcicki left YouTube. Mm-hmm. You got the DeepMind people. You know, it's all these different fiefdoms, little kingdoms. And so it's just going to be hard for them to make change. I don't think they're going to fall as far behind on the AI stuff as people think. I think they're just more thoughtful about releasing stuff because they're Google. Because they have antitrust issues, because they have a monopoly. So they just got to be careful, you know, scaring people. That's my understanding. It's like they just don't want to scare people at how good this stuff is. But now that cat's out of the bag and Microsoft's going for it, you'll see more coming out. And it is important for them if they're going to be third to Azure and AWS to make it a sustainable business. I think we talked about this early on the top of the show. Just everybody's trying to make these businesses sustainable.
Yeah.
And they got too many employees at these companies. So I would expect them to cut more people to hit their numbers and get this to be a growth story and get the stock to move.
So 190,000 employees, I think that number was inclusive of employees they've cut, right? So you're coming up on 200,000 employees and you want to streamline operations and make things move faster. Hmm. Is that a thing you can do? Is that like, is there a corporate story where a company that's this rich and then that large and human kind of capital has managed to actually become more agile? Because poor companies can just cut tons of stuff because they're out of money. Google is still incredibly wealthy. And so I wonder if there's like a natural inertia to just being that rich, and that makes it harder to actually make the hard choices to get faster.
When you're sitting on ungodly amounts of billions of dollars, tens of billions, or in Apple's cases, hundreds of billions of dollars, it's kind of hard. And when Sundar's taken down whatever tens of millions of dollars in stock comp, hundreds of millions of dollars, it's a hard message to say, we need to get rid of this entire group. We need to lay these people off. And did you see the TikTok reaction when Google made these? I mean, just every person who 6 months ago was making, here's my day at the Google office in New York, and I'm getting a matcha latte with soy. And then I went and I got a back rub, and then I did yoga, and then I did some email, and then I went home. And you're like, I think you like, did more non-work than then, work.
Yes.
But okay, sure. Maybe I'm just an old Gen Xer who liked to grind. So yeah, there is communication issues. I'll be honest. They did none of these companies, because of their cash positions. It's a really interesting point you kind of alluded to there. None of them had to make any of these cuts. So then you say, hey, why are they making the cuts? These are sacrificial cuts. These are motivational cuts. These are entitlement cuts. Great irony of irony. Google created entitlement culture. They were like, let us do your laundry. There's a coffee bar on your floor. And right. Guess what? There's going to be a coffee bar on the other side of the floor, so you can walk half as far. And yep. Yeah, we upgraded the beans to Blue Bottle because Facebook has fills. I mean, entitlement culture was bonkers at the peak. We lived it here in the Bay Area. You lived it. You saw it. It was nuts.
It was great.
It was awesome.
until it went away.
And I think people, and I don't blame employees for when somebody says, we'll do your dry cleaning, for saying, okay. I mean, just to say okay when somebody offers you something is nothing wrong with that. But I think they want to scare employees.
Mm-hmm.
Into performance, perhaps back to the office eventually, and it is a power play. I think it is as much about getting people to perform as it is about getting the bottom line. So removing M&Ms or whatever sacrificial, you know, services go away, massages, whatever, that's good. Getting some costs out is good, but I think it's really just to motivate people to work harder and to maybe take back power. Because the power dynamic was flipped.
Was flipped, but I don't think it actually ended up landing in the hands of like the individual Googler. I think it ended up just so diffuse through the middle management setup that the company didn't realize how sticky it became to make decisions and do things. And that it's reasonable. If you have a ton of money and you have a big problem space and your competitors are rich, you do a lot of stuff, you know? I mean, Microsoft makes hardware still, you know, and Google tried Stadia. And Amazon, they had a Halo brand they just shut down that was like wearables. Microsoft tried a wearable too. So these companies are always going to kind of, I think, expand outwards. And there might be periods when they just rapidly contract to fix that. But I don't think it stems the long-term problem, which is how do you run a business that's this big, this rich, and this essentially almost its own nation state without there just being inherent bloat?
There's going to be bloat. Yeah. There's always going to be bloat. I think it really is when the founders say, hey, we're going to ship this cadence. I'm building smaller groups who are building these elite projects. And you'll see it once in a while where they take a couple people out of the building and they're like, this is the war room. This is the group that's going to do Bard. And, you know, they've made some combinations of Google Brain and DeepMind. Mm-hmm. You start seeing people move to different buildings and being on like SWAT teams. And, hey, we're going to release this product in 30 days. It can be done.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of distraction. I don't know if you were on the episode where we talked about it, but I was like, people are doing petitions at Apple. Uh-huh. And I'm like, can you imagine Steve Jobs coming to work one day and people are like, Mr. Jobs, there's a petition on your desk from 800 employees. He'd be like, oh, okay, great. Can I see that list? And then he's like, hold on a second. And he just looks down the list. He takes three names off of it. I'll bring these three people to my office. And then the other 997, just take this to HR and
just fire them all
and turn off their badges.
But that's not just the founder dynamic. That's also the fact that if you have a very firm perspective on where you think things are going, you don't have to listen as much to other people. But if you are, as you noted, a consensus person with founders over their shoulder and you don't have anything like a controlling stake at the company, like I'm sure Sundar is very wealthy and shout out to him. Well done. But like, I don't think he owns more than what a point to the company.
Oh, much less.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's gotta be much less.
Generous.
Yeah. I think so it's much less. And he doesn't have founder authority. Like you're saying, he's got the founders in the board of his shoulder. And then he's got to try to keep really talented people in the game. But it's a profitable company. It's an ad based company still largely. So cloud's de minimis when compared to the ad business. It's moving up.
Yeah, moving up. I mean, $7.5 billion in the first quarter, up 28% year over year. It's now bigger than YouTube's ad business, and the only thing bigger than it is search. Now, you're right. Compared to the aggregate revenue portion, it's, you know, 12%, whatever. But like, it's the only growth thing there. And as we're going to see from Microsoft in just a second, like that remains the story, that the cloud is really pulling these majors forward. Like, you know, 3% growth at Google, 7% at Microsoft. But what was the biggest and fastest growing thing? It was Azure, their public cloud. So it's the same story with Microsoft, although it does feel like there's a little bit more operational discipline, I would say, in Redmond than Mountain View, just because they've been already through the founders are gone, new CEOs come in, and then they've already gone through the next stage of that, which is, okay, that didn't go as we planned. So now we need to find the next, essentially, tech person to lead the thing. Satya, in that case.
And there is a vibe going through Silicon Valley after Twitter reduced their headcount by 80% or so. That was extreme, but that sort of got Zuckerberg on board with, okay, I could go with 10% less. I could go with 20% less. And so now between Elon's 80%, you know, and Google 6 and Zuckerberg's 15, there is some consensus of we can do more with less. And how much less with AI is going to be a big question, because meeting developers who now are going faster. I was on a website and I've been playing with the plugins. I don't know how much you're doing ChatGPT-4, but I've been playing with the plugins and I'm like, this does feel like the bottom 30% of what I do. 30% of what I do could be automated in the next 6 months. Now, that doesn't mean I lose my job. It means I get back 30% of my time and I can deploy it somewhere else. So either way, there's a massive efficiency coming to America, to the world. And I think that is going to change the percentages, the single digit percentages we see here. Those things could double through the combination of attrition of cost and efficiency of who remains. This is a double win that I think is on the horizon. And I think this is what works us out of this recession.
So I like nearly all of that, but I want to clarify a point on the use of ChatGPT, because one thing I think a lot about is GitHub Copilot, which is the thing that helps you write code. And what I'm trying to figure out is, are we getting to the point where self-driving cars are today in terms of Copilot? Because my Subaru can stay in the lane. It can tell me when to slow down. It can't do intra-city stuff. Okay, fair enough. But it's still really great. So is Copilot for GitHub going to be like my car, or is it going to be like self-driving autonomous vehicles pretty soon and actually be able to do whole things for me or just assist? And if it's the whole thing, then I mean, fire half the staff. But if it's just the help, then you're right. 30% back, everyone's more efficient, but it's not like a sea change. It's more of a acceleration.
Yeah. So I think your analogy is correct. We're at level 2 self-driving where you kind of take two functions away. So I have adaptive cruise control at 7 car lengths, 3 car lengths, like even my backup ICE engine Suburban that I have in case my Teslas are, you know, something hits the fan and I need to get out of Dodge with gas because of zombie apocalypse. That has, it doesn't have lane control, but it does have adaptive cruise control, right? And then you have on your Subaru both. So highway, you're good. You know, like the chance of getting an accident on a highway, if everybody had that, is pretty low, and does give you back. It's just less arduous to drive, right? That's what I find is I'm less exhausted after a 2 or 3 hour drive to Tahoe. I do think your analogy is correct, except on the low end tasks, it does 100%. So I'm trying to think of the right analogy, highway driving versus city driving, sure. But there's a lot of like, items of research that we do as journalists, or you know, I was doing a research of LPs because I'm having my angel summit up in Napa, and I was like, you know, I'm going to invite some of the big endowments or whatever, see if anybody wants to come. And you know, I asked it for the large endowments, then I put it in a table, then I said sort it, and I was like, this is something I'd pay somebody $35 an hour to do. I might use Crunchbase for, so I'm paying a subscription, and it's just kind of doing it. And then I'm playing with the playground on OpenAPI. And I'm like, okay, give me the people at the Ford Foundation. I want the Twitter handles. And then I'm like, you know what I really want to do is I want to follow them on Twitter. And then I want to follow them on LinkedIn. I want to like a post, or I want to DM them or in-mail them. Now, I can't do those last 2 or 3 things. And that would be the left-hand turn into an intersection.
Right.
But I had 17 developers show me they did it in an hour. When I said, this is the next piece I need to do. They're like, I wrote the code for you already. It's like, it took me an hour. So this weekend, I'm going to start playing with some of the dev, you know, sandboxes. And I haven't done development since BASIC and Pascal and, you know, the 90s. And so, I do think it's going to go faster than self-driving, is my long answer to your short question.
I really hope you're right. But here's the problem that I see. When I look at all the stuff Microsoft is doing, they are doing Copilot for X. They're building AI into Exchange or into Dynamics CRM or whatever. Cool. Fine. That's great. Thank you. But what I want is a new separate program that is at the OS level that can interact with everything for me and that I can give increasingly complex commands to. I want it to say, go to my email, pull 10 names, drop those into a Google Sheet, send that to Bob, and then I want you to grab me 10 stock prices, print them out or whatever. You know, I want Siri, but amazing. And I want it to have these functions that are now possible thanks to LLMs. And my vibe is if LLMs can write code, as they pretty much can, and if they can take complex spoken assignments and figure out what to say next, why can't they write code and figure out what to do and say next in a way that we couldn't before, and then let them just do a lot? And so if this is it's Friday. I'm very tired. So like that wasn't the best explanation of what I'm trying to say.
No, I think it's a great one, actually. You're describing a workflow, and then you're describing, you don't want to have to stitch the workflow together and make sure it works. You want to tell an AI what the workflow is and have it done. And I am using plugins right now. I was able to get on plugins this week. Somebody at OpenAI was nice enough to push me up the list. And I started using Expedia and Kayaks. And I have a trip next week where I'm going down to Laguna and I'm speaking about AI in the hospitality space of all things. And it turns out like a lot of the first things are hospitality things, OpenTable, Kayak, Expedia. And I'm like, okay. So I start asking them, can you please tell me what are the closest airports to Laguna, right? Because I know I can go to Long Beach, et cetera. And then give me a list of flights, sort them by length of flight and then distance to Laguna. And it couldn't get that second piece, but it got the first piece. And I was like, okay, it's almost there. And then the next piece I would normally do if I was going to be there for a week was tell me the top rated restaurants on Yelp and then search the web and look for eater listings of the hot new restaurants. Give me a list of those and tell me what the top three dishes at each place are and put them on a map.
Yeah.
It's going to be and able then, to do that by the end of the year.
And then when I can do that with voice, that's going to be, that's the thing, because then I can be typing and also talking and I can get two things done at once. But back to your point about the hospitality section and sector and AI, my first thought was, that's ridiculous. My second thought was, where are labor costs the highest percentage of COGS? Probably hospitality.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, they're going to go AI first. Yeah. So,
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. The concierge, a lot of that stuff is going to, we're going to see what we saw during COVID, I think. I don't know if you had this experience where a restaurant that had, couldn't get waiters, and you're like, two for lunch, we don't have a reservation. And they're like, it's going to be half an hour. And you're like, but there's a third of the tables are open. And they go, we don't have enough servers or back of house staff to cook the food. So if we seat you, we're still not going to be able to serve you. And you're like, can I sit at the table in an hour? And you're just like, this is a very weird moment. And then they put Toast or one of those systems in where they get rid of waiters. You order it yourself, you pay for it yourself. And they took 2/3 of the, they just have runners now, right?
And pretty much.
That's San Mateo right now. All right. Probably the most challenging thing I hear from founders is related to building. Either they aren't technical and they're searching for a technical co-founder, or they can code, but they're just spread way too thin. This is one of the first major obstacles you're going to face as a founder. And it can be discouraging, right? We all know that. And when you're spread thin, you can't get the product velocity, it's very frustrating. You know what to do, but you're just stuck in the execution phase. So here's a solution. Let Crowdbotics be your CTO as a service. And boom, just like that, you can focus on building awesome products and delighting your customers rather than wasting your time on infrastructure planning, architecture, compliance, and the boring stuff. Crowdbotics also offers professional scoping to help you flesh out your project at the MVP stage and beyond. So cut out the hassle and get back to building that perfect product. When you think about Crowdbotics, I want you to think getting time back to focus on your product and customers. Product drives everything. So let the folks at Crowdbotics show you how it works. Schedule a free scoping session and get your detailed build plan at crowdbotics.com/twist. That's crowd, BOTICS.com/twist.
I'm gonna drag myself by the scruff of the neck back to the earnings thing and just say a couple of quick things. Azure growth, 26% in the next quarter. So pretty good looking ahead. And Microsoft is already attributing 1% of Azure's growth, which is their public cloud, to AI in the next quarter. And Jamin Ball, who used to be at Redpoint and is now at Altimeter, I think. Okay. Anyways, he does a lot of really great analysis on tech stocks. And he said, I think that that 1% works out to like $450 million in revenue for Azure AI already as a run rate.
Tracks.
Yeah. So that's actual real, you know, nine-figure dollars. That I think matters a lot. And then elsewhere in Microsoft, I'm not going to go through this all like LinkedIn and so forth, but Windows, not so good. Everything else, medium good. Company made. it's Q3 net income, fiscal Q3, calendar Q1. Jason, $18.3 billion.
That's cash in the bank. We got it. We secured the bag. I mean, they could buy, you know.
It's $1.5 billion a week. It's $200 million a day.
It's like, amazing.
I'm so poor. And
it's
not.
It's a money printing machine. It's a money printing machine. Yeah. And they did layoffs too. And they're getting people back to the office. And I do think that cloud is going to see significant gains because of AI, because every company I'm working with, to spend $1,000 extra, say you have a $150,000 developer.
Sure.
And you spend $1,000 on AI credits for that developer to be faster. So you spend 8% of their salary or something, but you make them twice as fast or 50% as fast. Like, this is a pretty good bargain. It's like paying for Grammarly for a writer, you know, and you're like, okay, Grammarly is 10 bucks a month and you're going to not make as many spelling errors. I don't need to get a proofer for you. Great. So it's, I think we're.
Oh.
Yeah.
I just had an idea. Jason. Yeah. So you're describing essentially the ability for software to increase human productivity, and then you're looking at the cost of humans and then kind of working that back to the efficiency of software and how it's a good deal.
Yeah.
This actually means that we could essentially tie the price of software to the cost of human labor. And as humans get more expensive, it becomes effectively more valuable. Ergo, you can charge more for it. So what we should do is raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour, and then every tech company will be worth $40 trillion. I figured it out.
It is, this is going to be the natural tension that occurs. We're going to see the concept of a 10x developer is changing. That developer who, you know, was Supergirl or Superman and they could fly, and the other superheroes were like Batman or the Flash. They can't exactly fly, but they can do some cool stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, guess what? Everybody in the Justice League cannot fly. And you're like, okay, that changes the dynamic. Well, people who were, you know, a 2x developer, not a 10x developer, they're going to become 7x developers. And the 7x is going to become a 10. You're just going to have a lot more really fast developers, which means software is going to move at a faster pace. And it's all going to be deflationary. So software will get cheaper and talent will get cheaper. You can already see on the websites like Fiverr and stuff like that, that people who scrape things like Crunchbase or PitchBook or LinkedIn, those jobs of like, hey, I can find you leads for a dollar, or now I can find you 10 leads for a dollar. I can find you a lead for a penny. I can do a scraping job. I can do, and that's all because of AI and scripting. So it's just going to be continued deflationary impact until I think there'll be a choice of either redeploying those people's times.
Yeah.
Or reducing headcount and reducing costs. And so you'll see a bit of both. Looking at Meta, I think that's a... So anyway, Microsoft crushed it again. Incredible job.
Can I do my Meta segue? Because I was thinking one up when you were finishing your sentence. I was going to do something like, you know what else is not driving efficiency? The Metaverse. Hey! Sorry, it's
You got to give him credit. He's like, okay, I don't want to get disrupted, so I'm going to do a crypto project. And then he's like, the world really doesn't want me to control crypto after I screwed up elections in dozens of countries and created, all kinds of psychological issues in young children and eating disorders. So he pivots off of crypto. Remember that crypto project that we're going to do?
Vividly.
Libra, whatever it was going to be. Then he hasn't pivoted off of Oculus and Metaverse, but he certainly has not talked about it. And he talked about AI a lot more in these earnings calls. So he wants to win. I bought the stock at $94 the Monday after he said he was going to cut 10,000 people. It's the best trade I've made in a while. And his stock continues to go higher because They had negative revenue growth for three quarters. This made people believe that this was, okay, you're AOL.
Right.
This is the start of the slide down. You hit a peak, and now we're going on the other side of the hill. But he cut headcount significantly. I know there were 4,000 more layoffs recently. 11,000 were in 2022. But now, the other part of the financial playbook. Alphabet, Google said they're going to buy back $70 billion. He says he's going to buy back $9 billion. And so, all of that put together, I think, has led people to believe that he wants to win. And he is nimble. So, you look at Google, not nimble. Microsoft, super nimble. Zuckerberg, most nimble. And so, if you're going to place a bet, you're going to place a bet on Microsoft and Zuckerberg right now, and you're going to move your money out of Google into those two companies.
And if you don't agree with that, you can send an email to Jason's email address and not mine. But to kind of carry on your point, they did post revenue growth 3% in the first quarter. Obviously, to your point, not a growth stock. But if you go from negative growth to positive growth, it's literally night to day. Like, yes. Like the sun comes out. There's a future in front of you. Cash flows might expand, especially if you're laying off people. My beef, though, with the company's results is all that's great. And the company had net income of $5.7 billion. That's a lot of money. Congratulations. Their spending on the metaverse stuff is still incredibly high. I forget the exact number, but I think the operating loss on Reality Labs was just around $4 billion in the quarter.
And unbelievable. That's huge.
They're not being nimble of getting away from that.
I think it's going to be hard to slow it down. And I think he still believes Apple is going to release their headset the end of the year, which we keep hearing, and that he needs to be part of that. And so, while AI is clearly going to change everything, he still believes, and Apple still believes, that AR is going to change everything. So, is it possible for us to have two platform shifts at the same time? Of course it is. We had cloud computing and mobile happen at the same time. So,
and
it's
that
not
was
like...
awesome.
Yeah, because you combine the two. Your photos... we're suddenly went from being on micro SD cards and offloading and external hard drives to all of a sudden mobile me becomes iCloud and it works. And Google Photos works, right? They bought Picasso or whatever. And now we had something on our mobile phones that was a huge problem and arduous. And everybody's going to Best Buy to get memory cards and memory card readers. And now all of those are collecting dust because it's all abstracted to the cloud via mobile. Well, now you put AI and AR together. Well, who knows how those two come together, but the mind does start to think about really interesting applications.
Yeah, and I'll just say this. I'm a long-term VR bull. I'm a short-term VR bear because I just bought a new gaming PC the other month, and I did not buy fancy nerd goggles for it. And I'm waiting for the reason to do it. And I'm going to do it. I have a sim racing setup. Like, you know, I didn't have a child until recently, so I had a lot more free money.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do it. And I just don't know yet. So to me, like it almost feels like they're like the iPad. It's like the pre-iPad smartphone when they're taking an old OS idea, putting it in the wrong form factor. It's not quite there yet, but something's going to break the logjam. And maybe this is the right long-term bet. But at $4 billion a quarter, that's a hard thing. It's a hard call option to keep paying the rate on, you know?
Every single Thanksgiving and Christmas, somebody's going to bring the new Oculus. I'm going to try it. I'm going to do the try, oh my, and goodbye. I'm going to put it on and go, wow, they made great progress. And then I'm going to hand it back to whoever brought it and be like, thanks. And I did it again this Thanksgiving. I played a game that was like a breakout game. I played a Star Wars game. I got about 30 minutes of time twice. And I was like, that's enough for me. I want to play Age of Empires or like a real-time strategy game like StarCraft 2. Those are more appealing to me than these, you know, VR games, as impressive as the technology is. But do you think there's a material difference between VR and AR in this regard? Because I am VR not interested and I'm AR fascinated.
So I remember the first time I put on, maybe actually the only time I wore Microsoft's HoloLens product. This was years and years and years ago, probably like, oh gosh, forever ago. Yeah. And they were still in like the development form. They're like, you know, big wires coming out of them. And I got to play with an AR kind of like Roblox type game, or sorry, a Minecraft type game in the real world. And it mind blowing. And so going back to our AI idea about combining workflows together and having more speech built into these products and so forth, you're still going to want to have the ability to have written text appear to you. And yeah. so there may be some sort of ability to take AR and AI and make them into something that's quite interesting in a unified sense. But I don't actually think that's a gaming context. I think that's a work/life context, not an entertainment context.
I agree.
And that's exciting to me. So yeah, I can see that.
It's like a guide. You know, you're like, hey, Siri. And then all of a sudden this person pops up and you're like, can you get me the legal assistant? And the legal assistant pops up. And now you have like Princess Leia being projected from R2-D2 in your field of vision. And you're like, hey, I need to do a non-disclosure agreement with this person. I want it to last, a year. And they're like, in what jurisdiction do you reside? And you're like, California. Oh, what jurisdiction do they reside? I'm like, London. They're like, oh, okay. Well, you're going to need to file one in London because, you know, it doesn't apply the California law to there. And, you need to answer these six questions. Would you like to answer them now? And boom, 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 boom. And the AI is like, oh, I actually have four of those answers for you. Boom. Like that. This is a compelling future. And the Minority Report or Blade Runner, where he's like, move five to the left, zoom in here, go there. And he's talking to the computer, like analyzing a picture. That's the stuff that's going to get super interesting, I think. And the workflow you described being super frustrating for you.
Yeah.
Get me these earnings reports, send it in an email, put it into a Google Sheet. You combine that with AR and it's happening on a desktop over here. And you mentioned I'm working over here. So, hey, I'm doing a podcast. I'm talking to J-Cal and I'm like, I ask you a question. Hey, what was BlackBerry's earning decline? You're like, hold on a second. Can I get BlackBerry's earning decline in a chart from the peak to the trough? And it's like, boop, comes up on the screen. Yeah, coming right up. This stuff is going to be incredible. Congratulations to Zuckerberg. He's staying remote too. That's another interesting sort of rub to it. And it seems like he will keep cutting people until morale and performance continues.
So
the beatings will continue until morale improves.
I use that in a headline, but I flipped it. I said the layoffs will continue until investor morale improves. And it seems to have finally worked out because Facebook, of all of these companies we're talking about today, had the best post-earnings share price appreciation. People were very excited about what they were doing because they returned to growth. They cut a lot of people and they said the magic word, which was AI, a million times on the earnings call, and investors lost their shit and they were so happy.
This is where AI would come in helpful. Hey, AI, can you tell me for each of these earnings calls how many times AI was mentioned? And we could just chart that and we could just chart it over time for the last four quarters and see. I loved a friend of the pod, Brad Gerstner's tweet. I guess he went to Midjourney. And I heard there's a Discord. My kids were and my wife were at dinner in a Discord doing Midjourney, making Jedi bulldogs. And here's what Brad made. He made Zuckerberg looking like he was on the juice, on steroids, taking PEDs. He looks like Westbrook.
he looks like
Westbrook's taking PEDs either, but
no, he looks like Superman not wearing a blue Speedo.
It's a bit much,
but what I like about that particular thing is it captured the core elements of Zuckerberg's face, but it actually aged him a bit, and he looked he looked there more like he was like 45. I don't know how old he is today, but he looked older there. And I don't think it didn't look bad on him.
No, it's a good
maybe
look.
That's predictive AI via Midjourney.
This is what I'm witnessing with all my friends. I hit 52 years ago. All of my friends who are in their 50s now are like, you know what? I'll be dead soon. I might as well have the best body of my entire life in my 50s. And they're like, you can do it, J-Cal. All you have to do is work out four times a week and eat chicken without the skin on it. And you too can have the best body and look like Jeff Bezos or AI Zuckerberg. So you just have to sacrifice food and lift pleasure. Heavy things. Yeah, sure.
Sounds so good. I'll lift heavy things. I'll do cardio. But like, since I gave up drinking, I'm going to eat candy. Like the non-negotiable. I will die with a Kit Kat.
What do you
got
to go to? Are you a chocolate sour candy? Your equal opportunity. What's your
main candy sub verticals? There's chocolate. There's fruit, and then there's sour.
Yes.
And to me, each has such a high peak to it that you must visit all three mountains on a regular basis.
Very cool. Wow. Look at that. So you like to climb multiple summits.
Sometimes on the same night while consuming some California-based vaping products. And perfect. You can just
absolutely. Herbs will enhance the flavor. I can confirm from a friend.
If all right, my, yeah. Anyways, Amazon.
Yes.
Hey, speaking about green things, Amazon yes. makes a lot of money. AWS is doing well, but actually had lower, I think it was, operating income than last year. Did that worry you, Jason?
You know, I'm a shareholder in Amazon. I believe in Amazon. I believe they're not fit. I think they need to keep laying people off. Amazon Web Services growth is slowing. Mm-hmm. And I know what's happening here. Okay. I am not concerned about the slowdown in cloud computing. We talked earlier about people who were signing leases for 2 years from now, hiring people from 2 years from now. The same thing happened in cloud. People were provisioning, and they were basically like somebody who didn't have to keep track of what's in their pantry, just filling the pantry. So they were, you know, developers were putting up instances, never turning them off, and they just were not, you know, managing the pantry as tightly as they should. Now, when you saw the layoffs happen last year and you saw the contraction in the economy, everybody said, what is our spend? Now, I'm not going to say specific names, but we had like a couple of different email products we were using. They were costing thousands of dollars a month. And we had a bunch of mailing lists and we were getting charged based on the size of the mailing list. And I'm like, we haven't emailed this list in a year. And I said, do me a favor, can you put that list for Founder University, for our Angel Summit or our Angel University? Can you just put those on a Substack? Because Substack's free. Well, actually, I put them on Review before Twitter got rid of Review.
Ugh, RIP Review.
RIP Review. And so, but I was like, wait a second, Substack is free. I sent this list once a year, maybe twice. I don't need to pay a monthly fee for this. And so, boom, all of a sudden, $40,000 less in email fees across two companies. Can you talk about hundreds of thousands of emails? Now,
yeah, no, I'm just saying, that's a material savings.
Material
savings.
That's a
small car. Yeah.
It's half of a salary of somebody, right?
There you go.
And so, I think that's what's happening is everybody looked at their Amazon bills. And when your revenue's going up, top line's going up, you're like, whatever, who cares? This is like not that much money. But when you have to get rid of two people in your department, you're like, you know what? Do we have stuff we can move from the live storage to the glacial storage that doesn't need to be as fast? Oh, we had these instances running. Oh, we have this many CDNs. We don't need that much. Or let's renegotiate. And so the great renegotiation has occurred. That's what I think the slowdown is. It's not usage or utilization. People are using the cloud more than ever. It's just people are negotiating harder with their cloud providers and they're tidying up. And that's why you're seeing this belt tightening, which means people aren't being wasteful, which means I actually think these businesses are stronger than the percentage growth decline is showing.
Hard to agree with all of that. Also, we're lapping some pretty impressive results from a year ago, which were predicated on not the same belt tightening. Mm-hmm. So and the fact that we're still seeing double-digit growth across all three major cloud providers is very impressive. The only caveat to what you said is that in Amazon's earnings call, I was going back through it today, writing about this exact issue, actually, and they said that they were running growth in April for AWS was running 500 bips below Q1. Which means 5 percentage points, if you don't do bips out there. 16 minus 5 is 11. 11 is very close to 9. And 9 is a single-digit growth rate. And that doesn't change our thesis about cloud. But for Amazon in particular, given that their e-commerce business is unprofitable internationally and occasionally unprofitable in North America, they can't really afford to have their main growth engine and profit source slip a gear. And so I agree with you. I think that growth return is a couple of quarters out. It could get a little rough for some of
they
these
have
companies.
Competition too. We just mentioned that Azure has the OpenAI ChatGPT, the sexy new product, the new cars on the lot. They got the new Prius. They got the Tesla Model Y, whatever the hottest car of the moment is. And so, yeah, you could see people saying, you know what, I'll use Azure for this. And then Google Cloud is distant third. But you know, you do have competition in the space. I do like their advertising business. I think that's like pure drop to the bottom line. That's growing double-digit percentages. And then Uber added that. DoorDash has an advertising business. You're starting to see these advertising businesses in places where you didn't expect them. And when you've got a marketplace like Uber does, or Amazon does with third-party sellers, and then or DoorDash does with restaurants, and then you say to the folks who are in your marketplace, would you like to come up ahead of your competitors? Would you like to, what pages would you like to be shown as a, you know, what the double dash on DoorDash, you get to do a second thing. It's like, hey, can we show your ad after somebody orders from this restaurant? Do you want to show your boba or your, you know, liquor, you know, restaurant? And it's like, yeah, I think I would pay for that. Sure. I need more business. These businesses, I was in an Uber and I was just thinking, they know I'm ordering an Uber Black. Okay, great. There's a signal. They know my zip code. They know my address. What are the chances they know the value of my home? What are the
98%.
Chances? Yeah. And what are the chances they know the cost of my hotel? Okay. The hotel I was staying at, you know, in Japan, is, you know, I was staying at the Park Hyatt. It's not cheap. It's like $1,000 a night. That's the one from what do you call it?
Not White Lotus. The other one.
Lost in Translation.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'm at that hotel. It was $800 a night. It was during the marathon. But they know in Japan, I'm staying at this, you know, 5-star hotel, 4-star hotel. I mean, what's that worth to an advertiser? To know, hey, would you like the people who stay at the top hotels in the world? This person's been to Japan, Austin, Miami, and LA in the last year, and their hotels cost $800 or $600 on average. They're 4 or 5 stars. This person is staying at Holiday Inn. So if it was J.Cal during the Weblogs Inc. era, me and Brian Alvey were splitting a room at $150 a night hotel. I'm not kidding. We would get bed.
I've been
there. We'd sit there and we'd work until 2 a.m. and then sleep a couple hours and have breakfast together. You know, that advertising information is extraordinary. Do you want the person who bought, I just bought a $200 waffle machine for my daughters. Got this incredible one.
From my own heart. That's cool. What's it called?
It is the, what's the name? I'll tell you in 1 second.
Okay. Cause anyway, I got the best
waffle machine. just to flex a little bit.
Yeah, please.
Tyler Florence, the chef from the Food Network, just sent me the one to get. So I get it. And so it's that brand I love. Anyway, I'll send it to you after the show. But it's like you can make 4 full-size waffles at a time. Because I got 3 daughters and I had the single one. And I'm literally like making 1 waffle at a time. And like these 3 like baby tigers are going to rip each other to shreds over 1 waffle every 7 minutes. This one makes 4 every 4 minutes. So it's pretty different ball game.
I love that. But the advertising point's very good. And I'll tell you why. Because when you think about Instacart, people think about a delivery business, kind of, but they also make software for grocers. That's another thing. They also have a simply amazing amount of inventory for advertising. Because when I'm going to buy a thing, most of the time, I don't care if I'm buying Oreos or Chips Ahoy to pick up the first example that came to mind. But they have a lot of advertising space there and they're using it. And another company, Swiftly, I've known the founder of that forever, also working in the grocery space, explained to me how much CPG brands are, this was Henry Kim, how much CPG brands are willing to pay for like last touch advertising if they can change a sale on the ground. And so there's a ton of space here. I just think it's interesting that we're talking about these major tech companies' ad incomes. Like who would have thought that like the apex point of a tech company when they reach real scale is they can finally sell ads. But that does seem to be the case. I mean, Apple, and Microsoft. Pure profit.
And
bottom line.
And then, by the way, it's the Breville Smart Waffle Maker Pro. This is the only waffle maker that had an LED, you know, LCD screen and like settings at this level of granularity of crispness. It's absurd how good this thing is.
Spell the brand for me.
Breville.
Found it. Yeah, it does. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Breville. Now you got a kid.
The Smart Waffle Pro 4-slice.
Yeah, it's no joke. I mean, you could save $50 if you want to get the 2-1. Maybe a family of 3 could get by with that. I had to go industrial. These kids are killing me. I needed 4 waffles at a time. 1 for me, and 1 for each of the kids.
People who are watching this, not watching this on video, you can't see this, but like, it's literally has a feature called Waffle IQ. Intelligent automation dials in your cooking time perfectly to suit the waffle style, including Belgium, classic chocolate, and buttermilk. Like, oh my God, I love that.
I'm that idiot. And I probably saw it on an ad where it was trying to upsell me on the $39 one that I saw on Wirecutter that I was like, that's good enough. And it was good enough for 2 years. Now that you got the twins, it's no longer good enough. They're not splitting a waffle.
Once you're over 28, good enough is no longer an okay thing is my vibe.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Snap before we go, just really quick.
Yeah.
So Snap have you noticed how Snap only has 2 responses to earnings, which is up 20% or down 20%? Like, why is the stock so swingy? It's just, I want to give them a hug almost because they just get wrecked so much.
advertising, the advertising business is finicky. Advertisers, you know, during a down market will pull back. They will pause ad campaigns, they'll push them back. And I think, you know, performance-based advertising like Google search, or like we just talked about, Amazon's, you know, marketplace stuff, these things are very close to the purchase decision. The closer you can get to the purchase decision, the more scientific it is, right? So, okay, the waffle maker costs $279. I can pay $8 every time somebody clicks on it. Now, if that waffle thing is on the New York Times, it's like, okay, yeah, you, this person looks at recipes. Maybe I can pay 80 cents per person. And I got to hope that one out of 10 actually, you know, clicks. Yeah. And that's how I get to my eight, you know, clicks past, you know, they're not looky-loos. And so this is why Google has always, you know, with intent and being closer to the sale, and Amazon, obviously even closer to the sale. Uber might be very close to the sale. Hey, I'm going to the Warriors game. Where are you going to go out for drinks after, right?
Right.
So this is, I think, the core issue that Snap, Twitter, Instagram, you know, certain ad networks are going to, YouTube, are not close to a transaction. So they're getting brand advertising. Brand advertising, half the time it works, half it doesn't. Nobody knows which half works. That's the classic statement. And so it's just a little less predictable and, dare I say, essential as performance-based advertising.
Is the right word. I mean, I think essential is the right way to frame it, because when you have a reduction in spend across the economy and things slow down, you cut the non-essential things first, and brand advertising is the first thing to go. I don't think it's a shock or a surprise that we've seen so many media layoffs in the middle of a slowdown in advertising spending, and generally, especially on the brand side. I mean, a lot of this money just evaporated out of the economy. Snap's revenue dropped under $1 billion, down 7% year over year. And then the numbers just get brutal. It had a worse operating loss, a worse net loss. It did have more operating cash flow, but it's hard to find a lot that was exciting about this. And they got some really tough questions on the earnings call. And
One of them was particularly rude. I saw it trending and I didn't actually listen to it. I don't know if we do have it queued up here. Did you hear this?
I did.
I haven't heard it, so I'll hear it live for the first time here. Let's play this tape.
Our next question is from Rich Greenfield with Lightshed Partners.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I got a couple. You know, I guess given the infrastructure and creator investments that feel pretty vital to reversing the pressure you've seen on engagement and advertising, I guess the question is sort of, why aren't you scaling back your AR investments? You know, you talked about offsite partnerships, and I saw last week things like AR Coke machines or vending machines. Like, why not scale back AR investments until you're in a better financial position? You know, obviously, it feels like Meta's got the luxury of sort of walking and chewing gum when I look at like their metaverse investment. I'm not sure you have that luxury. So how do you think about, how do you balance sort of what you need to reaccelerate your core business versus sort of investing in the future? And then two, you know, I guess just a high, you know, a big picture question, Evan, of just, obviously you've got what now is going to be another quarter of revenue declines, at least based on your internal forecast in Q2. What gives you confidence that you can return to robust growth? Because I think obviously the big challenge here is investor confidence in you and the team.
Yeah, that's a little rough. Walk and chew gum at the same time, but fair, do you think?
Oh, absolutely fair. I mean, the reason why Meta can have its stock go up 15% after it reports earnings, and the fact that it lost $4 billion on a metaverse at the same time, is because its core business is gold. Tons and tons of gold. It prints bricks of money.
Yeah.
And I just pulled up Snap's earnings, so I had all the numbers. I mean, their net loss in Q1 23 was $329 million. And their revenue was $989 million. When you're running like a negative 30% net margin on a GAAP basis, you have fewer options. You have a less robust, you know, amount of maneuverability room.
Yeah, that question came from Rich Greenfield. I know him. Yes, he's a particularly sharp-elbowed. He's a bit of a provocateur, yeah?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. I don't think that question was actually rude. Because I think it's the venue that made it seem so rude. Because most people get on the call and they go, J-Cal, amazing quarter. You guys are the best. Thank you for taking the question. Just a small point. Can I clarify?
Of course.
Are you seeing channel flow with the sales?
Oh, thank you so much. What an intelligent question. Oh, thank you so much for the question.
A bull answer. and then nothing happens.
Ah, yes. Ah, yes. I just passed gas and it smells like roses.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So he asked the question. I mean, basically he said out loud what everybody's thinking, which is, come on, your business is struggling here. Get focused. You got to get focused. And he said he's going back to he was the one who said, hey, we're going back to the office 4 days a week or whatever. We don't have the luxury of that. So he's an enigma to me.
He's an enigma to me too. I've never spoken to him. I don't know him at all. I do like stuff about Snap. I do like that they stayed independent, that they had a very different take on social, that they managed to capture new demographics, that they've done investments into original content and creator stuff earlier on. I wore Snap spectacles. I thought they were awesome. They're killer at brand. But ultimately, they're a small social network in a world of much bigger companies that have better ad leverage. Like, this is the Twitter problem all over again. So
yeah, I mean, are you essential or not? And in a down market, people are going to just cut, and simplify. Maybe we'll just focus on the two or three things that are working and we won't be as experimental with our ad budgets. And so if you were experimental on Snap or Twitter or TikTok, you might cut that and just focus on your Amazon, ads and your Google ads and your Facebook ads, right? So you can only focus on so many things, back to the, walking and chewing gum.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the issue here. They do have an impressive number of people using the service. I mean, it's about 350 million people or something. Like, people are addicted to the service, and it's an audience that is valuable. It's young people, so it's valuable to brand advertisers. But in a down market, advertising gets walloped, and they are going to keep. They're going to need to keep cutting costs and to show some profits here. And show growth. So
yeah, I know we have to go because we're over time, but just before I bounce and go back into babyland, this is a question about social media, but what's your vibe on people that want to ban or not ban TikTok from the United States?
So it is crazy that the United States would not demand reciprocity with China.
Yeah.
It is also crazy to think that the Chinese government would treat Americans differently than they treat their own citizens. Their own citizens are tracked in apps. They're tracked with facial recognition, and they have a social score. And if people don't pay their debts, they are scarlet lettered inside these apps. If people don't, if people smoke on a train or eat food on it, they can have their social scores, a la Black Mirror, that famous episode where you're rating each other. So we would have to be completely naive to think that the Chinese government, the CCP, would not use this as a weapon against Americans. The obvious answer, and this has nothing to do with your politics, you just need to look at what Huawei or any country would do, or swap out China for Russia or Iran or North Korea. If they owned this app and they had this amount of access to Americans, you'd be like, well, I'm not giving Putin access to this many Americans. Period, full stop. So it has to be divested. And the investors who are in that company want a return. This is the greatest IPO of the next couple of years. So if the board wants a return, the investors want a return, and it's not going public, why?
Well, I know why it's not being divested. Well, one, I agree with all that, by the way.
Okay.
We're on the exact same page. I was just curious if we were in alignment here. But the reason why it won't be divested is that the last thing that I read about this was that the Chinese government doesn't want to appear to be forced to do that.
So they want to save face.
Yes, but also it kind of makes a point that this thing is not controlled by China, but yet it can't be divested and go public because Chinese government says no. So we're on the same page here.
I mean, it basically proves the point as you described it.
Yeah.
Investors want to go public. Investors want there to be a float and free trading of the shares, which would then, if it was a freely traded company, it would not be owned by CCP anymore. And there's a person from the CCP on the board, and they have said no. Why would they say no? It's an asset.
It's an asset.
It's obvious. Now, if you want to be Taylor Lorenz and you want to be like, well, TikTok, the creators need to make money and we are not thinking about them and we have no proof, that's just complete naivete.
I like Taylor, but I do disagree with her on this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's literal complete naivete. It'd be like, people be like, oh, wow, no, I met this Russian spy and they didn't spy on me and they didn't compromise me. And it's like, how do you know that? They could have like swapped out your SIM card when you were at the bathroom. Like you're dating a Russian KGB agent. Like,
yeah. The thing that I would say is that I don't like, there's a certain vibe amongst certain people in tech. And this is actually across every possible group in the industry. And even the media that covers tech, in which there's this like, almost like a point of pride that we're all like outside in the dark smoking cigarettes saying, well, we're always being tracked by American apps too. Who cares?
That's weird.
And yeah. And to me, the answer is no, we can fight surveillance capitalism at home. And we can also point out that there's a greater national security risk when it involves a hostile foreign power that is trying to exterminate a part of its population. So yeah, we're on the same page, but we should probably stop talking. So I think we're
yes. Up. I mean, your analogy is exactly right.
Yeah.
I think we could be absolutely, against what's happening to the Uyghurs in China, while also looking at the American prison system saying, hey, we got too many people in prison and the death penalty is not deployed fairly here. But these are two different things.
Yes.
Genocide and, you know, our incarceration system being flawed. These are both can be solved and addressed, and they could be different magnitudes of risk and or wrong in the world. All right. Alex Wilhelm, you can follow him on the Twitter. And go subscribe to TechCrunch Plus. You know, get that in there. Support great independent editorial. And on Twitter, he is part of the First Name Club at Alex.
Yes,
thank you, and my brother.
Jason, thanks for having me on as always, and a real treat. And I'll just say this: may summer come quickly. May we all go surfing, and let's all get a nap because we need it.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody get a good nap, and see you next time, everybody. Bye bye.